Hey, I'm Terry Foley.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Welcome to the Tailgate Podcast. We talk about college lacrosse, and I am doing so on a Sunday afternoon with Nick Osello. Nick, how you doing, man?
I'm good. Terry, that was a bit of a weird intro. Did I rattle you right before we hit record?
You kind of did, but also that is a subtle shout out to Drew Carter, who we talked about on last week's podcast, and I ran into at the PLL on Friday where he was calling the action from Centerville Bank Stadium. And if you listen to the Hoop Collective, which is probably my favorite podcast, or at least most listened to, you have heard Drew get shouted out on there several times. And yeah, that was what we talked about. So he said that I had to channel that in my intro. So is what it is.
If you get it, you get it. I'm doing fantastic. We were briefly talking about it, but it's not my favorite weekend of the year, nor is Memorial Day my favorite weekend of the year, even if Notre Dame wins. I feel the same way about almost every season as it kind of whittles down. First day of March Madness is the best because you got the full slate.
100%.
And now we're kind of weaning off the ability to just cherry pick the best of college lacrosse and dive deep into four games, which is great for the analysis of the four games. However, I would be remiss if I said I start to get sad this weekend every year where I'm like, oh, we only have three games left in the season, but we're not going to harp on any negativity. It's going to be all positive. And honestly, three of the four games are worth talking about.
We are going to harp on some negativity, but we're going to start by just acknowledging your emotional vulnerability, Nick. We talked last week about how long we have been doing this together. We talked about your full conversion into speaking like Larkin. And now that we've got this, I don't know how to feel about an emotionally available Nick Osello, but it's going to make for some interesting podcasting. I feel that very strongly.
There's a single tear running down my leg, Terry.
Let's get to what was, in my opinion, the best game of the weekend, Syracuse 13, North Carolina 11. Nicky O, what was your number one takeaway, not just from this game, but for quarterfinal Saturday at beautiful James Sheward Stadium on the campus of Hofstra University?
This first off, I would be remiss if I didn't start out by saying this is the best venue for quarterfinals, and you have Long Island crazies all over the place, essentially a home game for Syracuse, even though UNC was represented really well. We had that comeback win against Albany on that same field. So good memories, insane fans, good acoustics, the right size. Love, love, love this venue, A+. The biggest takeaway for me was kind of crazy how narratives, which at least I thought going into games that would dictate their outcome, were flipped on their head. And I don't think there was a better example of it than the face-off X for Syracuse versus North Carolina. And I don't think it's a stretch to say that even the way that the Princeton game unfolded, even the way that the Notre Dame game unfolded, we'll talk on Duke in a second because they're a bit of a head scratcher for me to wrap my arms around right now. But the way that the champion is going to be crowned this year, I don't think is going to be how I don't think the path that we're expecting the champion to arrive at is going to be what we expect. That's just an absolute garbage sentence that I tried to put together, but I hope you're picking up what I'm putting down, because Wambach being the perfect X factor was, I thought, hit UNC's path to victory. Turns out it was Syracuse who got more productivity. And in the transition game, absolute chaos going back and forth. Ultimately, transition game and face-off X being the X factors for a Syracuse win. I thought it would have been an offensive shootout where both teams were trying to get a little bit more settled sixes. The goalie battle in the first two quarters. I'll let you unfold the game. But I just think that this was a narrative-shattering game for how teams are going to win the next three.
Okay, I think that's a good place to start. But I also think that you were very gracious in your praise of the venue. Now, everything that you said was true. However, you left out what was far and away the most impactful element, which was that they replaced the field surface in, like, March. And as a result, installed what appears to be a very soccer-friendly artificial surface that lacrosse players can't stay on their 2 feet on. And it was crazy because, and we're going to get to this at the end of this podcast, if you were one of the season-high listeners to the first round show, you heard us record live during Virginia-Georgetown, another game in which it seemed like nobody could stay on their own 2 feet. That was attributable to grass, and Larkin went in detail about the length of the grass and their ability to set it at whatever height they wanted to in order to get the advantage that they could potentially derive. Not the case when you're playing at a neutral site venue on an artificial surface. So that was really wild. And, you know, we'll talk about this in the Notre Dame-Hopkins game. Reese DeSico's injury, I think, is a direct result of the slipperiness of the surface. But I think while injuries were certainly a factor in pretty much every game this weekend, and we're going to talk about Owen Duffy here in a minute as well, I didn't think that the surface was the factor insofar as it led to injuries. I think it was who's going to adjust better to making cuts that they can not lose their footing on, or being dangerous without having to utilize sudden explosive change of direction, either offensively or defensively, in order to get it going. It really was like an episode of Slippery Stairs.
It was. I didn't think that for the Virginia game, if Larkin was on, he would say it's literally insane that kind of neutralize a lot of the advantages that I would think Virginia was trying to carry into the Georgetown game when it's neutral site. Neither team has played on it before. I put less weight towards it being a true advantage one way or the other. When it's a matchup like Syracuse UNC, where arguably, I mean, I think if you get into the nitty gritty of it, it would benefit Syracuse's settled offense a little bit more, a little less explosiveness, some more off ball craftiness, kind of the wheeling dealing unstructured structure to it. But with that being said, when there's both teams that are playing on that equal level playing field, your point, who can make the adjustments faster, I think it ends up being more of a wash than you might think.
I think that's fair and well said, but let's go back to the point that you made about the role of facing off and how Brady Wambach's dominance was certainly a reasonable starting point for Carolina fans looking for their third straight win in this series over the course of this season. You know, coming into the year, I had Wambach preseason number one, or preseason first team All-American, Johnny Mullen very clearly number two, second team, and I thought that there was a gap to whoever it was that you were going to put on third team and honorable mention. And Mullen just didn't have the season, and specifically the start to the season, that you would have expected. But he did get better as the year went along. And it wasn't to say that Wambach got worse necessarily, but he had fewer games where he was fully dominant. And the loss at Notre Dame that I was in attendance for was another significant example of, okay, he's not unbeatable, he's not invincible. The interesting thing about the way that it unfolded is that Carolina, and I think if we're going to talk about this game in sequence, it's hard not to talk about Owen Duffy, who missed the Albany game due to injury. He left the ACC championship game, lost to Virginia after it was out of hand. It's pretty clear now that it was a hamstring. And he gave it a go. He warmed up. He started. He didn't play the entire first half. He definitely came out, tried to get it loose, went into the locker room early at halftime in order to get it massaged and loosened up even further. Played, from what I could gather, a lot more in the second half. Didn't necessarily have an enormous hand in Carolina building an early lead, but that's what was interesting in the contrast to the faceoff performance, is that Syracuse was winning faceoffs, but they weren't converting it into goals. So once they finally did start to unlock the offensive efficiency and turn it a little bit more into a shootout, because what was interesting was, I think there was expectations that if there was going to be a game that looked like it was going to end up being a, call it 10-9, 11-8 game, whatever the case might be, it was of these two, it was going to be Notre Dame Georgetown. If there was a game that was going to combine for 26 goals or 24 goals, excuse me, I'm sorry, Notre Dame Georgetown, Notre Dame Hopkins. If there was going to be a game that was going to combine for 24 goals, which ultimately this one ended up doing, it was going to be Cuse Carolina. And it didn't look like that early on. It was much slower paced, much more of a defensive feeling out process. But Syracuse offense starts to click, and once they they get it tied, and then they build a 2-goal lead in the third quarter. And I remember at that point thinking, I don't think Carolina's offense has the juice in order to be able to get this back. And it wasn't exclusively about possessions. It wasn't about Wambach feeding them the ball. You know, it was also a function of what they weren't able to do on their ride with Duffy. I mean, he was trying, but he wasn't applying very much pressure. Even on one man down clear in the second half, you know, Cuse had a lot of time with the ball on their stick, which was, in my opinion, an example of you know, exactly how little pressure Carolina was able to apply with their ride. But I thought one of the stories early was the complimentary scoring that Carolina was able to get. But then ultimately, once, you know, Syracuse got it to, I think it was 8-6, maybe 9-7, Carolina's ability to then get it back to tie, I thought was really impressive. And then that set up what was the play of the game. Nick, you know which one I'm talking about?
Billy Dwan stepping out of bounds.
Billy Dwan. Well, let's save that for a second because, you know, first, Billy Dwan is one of the best stick handling long poles in college lacrosse. He is one of the most productive offensively defensemen in college lacrosse. And so, you know, it was interesting. He talked about it post game, how he was getting ridden to the sideline, and on the broadcast, they were like, why did he let them push him so, you know, close to the sideline when it felt like, you know, he probably could have put a shoulder into the riding attackman and kept his angle going forward. But all that being said, really nice backhanded underhand flip to, I believe, Dante Bowen, who gets it to Joey Spallina, who scores. This was with about 7 minutes to go in the fourth quarter to put Syracuse up 11-10. A really nice play. Let's set aside the fact that he was out of bounds for a second. Your thoughts on the play and what that goal meant for the game and how it was going forward. Because if you watched this like me, you did not realize at first that he was out of bounds. It took seeing the replay once, only once, but on initial view, I didn't realize that he had stepped out of bounds.
Neither did I, and that's just me being a Syracuse hater. It was a play that I thought was a dagger, even though it only put the score to 11-10. It just seemed like a singular moment of fruition of the narrative that we've talked about seemingly every time Syracuse has been brought up in the last 4 years, which is at a certain point, these Syracuse seniors, of which I think of the 11 starters, 8 or 9 of them were seniors. They've been put in high pressure situations for 4 years. And Billy Dwan has been in these situations for 4 years, Spallina for 4 years. And to me, that was just the representation of Syracuse's seniors' ability to rise to the occasion after battling 3 years ago and not having good seasons and figuring out how to act in these high-pressure situations. And ultimately, I think it was a good example as well of not every team and certainly not every roster is built for having the quote-unquote unstructured structure. Like, you really had to prove to Coach Corrigan if you were going to shoot as a long pole. I think, you know, Sexton was really one of the only guys that ever had that green light. You know, there was that structure of saying, you are this position and we expect you to make these types of plays. And for Dwan to have the green light as he's had, not only is really fun to watch, but it gets the comfortability level in high stress situations. This is the biggest moment of their season. It's tied. He's getting pushed out of bounds. How are you going to act? And he throws an unbelievable pass. So I thought that that was a dagger because of A, the momentum swing, but B, just saying, oh, they are going to be able to rise to the occasion. And this senior class is going to take them to the promised land. At least that's kind of how I viewed it was, oh, look at these guys finally rising to the moment. And I don't know. I really enjoy watching him. And Spallina, clutch. It was a fun game too. Like, it just seemed like every so often there was an unbelievable play from either side. And I would say, yeah, if you're going to watch one game, go back and rewatch that one, because the highlights themselves are amazing. But how even the highlights were set up and transpired and how the goal scored, so many interesting moments in the middle of the field, this being the cream of the crop.
So he did step out of bounds, and it is not reviewable. And of course, many lacrosse fans didn't know that. I'm not going to claim that I did. I did not know that, but I also reserved my online commentary in the moment to make room for not knowing that. I do think it's absurd that it's not reviewable. That when, you know, the institution of replay review in college lacrosse was a function of Garrett Lemon stepping in the crease. And it is clear the way the rules are written that it is very much a reaction to that, because so much of what is reviewable is play around the crease. Whether or not somebody is in or out of bounds is probably the most fundamental thing for video review to review, because it is not subjective. It is objective. Now, you cannot always tell based on the quality of the video, the angle relative to the foot, et cetera, et cetera. But usually you can, and I would argue that in the 15 year in which video review has become a scourge of the sports fan experience, whether or not he stepped out of bounds is probably the part that's the most acceptable to sports fans, and yet not in the rules. So save your criticism for Joe Bresci. Amplify your criticism for either the rules committee or whomever. But ultimately, the catch-22 that I find myself in is that whenever there's a blown call, the majority of the reaction is, we got to expand the power of replay. And that's how you find yourself in a situation where replay has sucked the soul out of what we like about sports. Nick, what's your take on this?
There just has to be a way in which there's the gentleman's replay. And like, hey, if it's clear and it makes sense, and I know that everything is just so stupid now where you have to have, oh, no, you have to have this written, and it has to be in the bylaws, and it has to be X, and it has to be Y, and it has to be Z. Like, there honestly just should be one gentleman's challenge a game. Reviewing whatever it is the coach wants to review. A step out of bounds, a ball crossing the goal line, you know, a crease dive, many of those are reviewable. I don't know what you can and what you can't review. I just think it's really stupid to get replays in place for a specific action. And it makes me think that the rules committee doesn't know lacrosse very well. I'm like, if there was a lacrosse player in that room, especially, you know, get Matt Cavanaugh in that room, or a writing attackman who's like, I've pushed defenders out and referees have not called it. Like, it's not a unique enough play to where it happens and you go, oh, we totally forgot to put that in the rule book, because once a season.
Exactly.
No, yeah. It happens once a game.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's stupid. There needs to be a gentleman's review.
It was the pivotal play in Brown-Yale.
Yeah.
The riding attackman pushes it was the Brown faceoff guy at his offensive end of the field. So I suppose it was a riding defensive midfielder pushes him out of bounds. And the question is, did he step out before he got rid of the ball? Not reviewable. Probably would have been nice to be able to challenge that one. Okay, so we have to provide a couple caveats in order for Keith fans not to justifiably yell at us. The first is, tie game, it would have been a 30-second push. They would have gone on extra man. If they score, it's not as if it changes the situation very dramatically. I think everybody that knows anything about sports knows that momentum is important. That was a huge momentum-building play. Equally, the butterfly effect will suggest that things aren't necessarily going to unfold exactly as they otherwise would have if you, you know, pull one Chenga stick out of the stack that was this game. But with that being said, the Orange extended their lead, and ultimately Carolina got one back, but wasn't able to get the game back within one. And Cuse was able to kill the last, I don't know, 30, 40 seconds. Really nice job they were man up, so it was 6-on-6, but playing four corners and throwing really long passes all around the field before Joey Spallina was able to throw the ball in the hair. Which I think brings us to the last kind of about this game comment, even though it's not the game, it's the post-game interview. So last year, Joey Spoelstra went full Ultimate Warrior in his post-game interview and really felt like he was speaking to the haters, whereas this time it felt so much more tinged with gratitude, would be the term that I would use to describe it. But he dropped an F-bomb. And I know that if you want to make your way into Nick Osello's heart, drop an F-bomb on national TV. Nick, what was your reaction to Joey's post-game interview?
I started clapping. I gave him a single-man standing ovation. And in a world riddled with coach speak, and we were even talking about trying to get Josh Yago on the pod, you know, as a potential guest today. And my initial reaction was government property Josh Yago. And I was like, probably not a good idea because I can already tell you all of the answers. And, you know, I want to know, and I know enough about him. Yeah, him in the locker room is a whole lot different than him in the media. And I think Joey Spoelstra finally giving the people a little bit of a sliver. I'm like, dude, you're from Long Island. Like, you know, stop pretending like you're not dropping the F-bomb every third word during a game, which to his credit, that's what you should do. You should just give the media boring answers and not get involved in any scandals or anything like that. But where's the fun in that? So him dropping an F-bomb, it was the cherry on top that solidified I wanted Syracuse to win this game from the get-go. But when he dropped the F-bomb, it was a huge rush of validation where I'm like, this is a better team just from a personality standpoint. And I will – I don't think I covered it, but I will give Syracuse's defense an extra kudos right there just because of all the teams that I thought – UNC and Princeton, I feel like I've thought about them in a pretty similar way. All season where, hey, even if, you know, Palumbo goes down for Princeton or Duffy goes down for UNC, they're still a really good unit and they can get supplemental scoring and they're not, you know, a one-legged bar stool like some other offenses where you take away one guy and all of a sudden the entire offense crumbles. Not just McCool and goal, but their ability to stifle UNC's six-man offense, and particularly the flow of it and the quality of their passes and applying the right type of pressure. I wouldn't say that it was the game. You know, I wouldn't attribute this win to Syracuse's defense, but I thought that there were some moments in which Syracuse's defense could have lost the game if they handled how UNC's offense approaches six-on-six situations. So consistently pretty damn good and consistently good enough to win this game, especially late after kind of the floodgates had opened. You know, who's gonna plug the dam? Syracuse did, UNC didn't.
Yeah, so a couple of reactions there. These podcasts are always really different from the first 16 weeks of the season because when Kevin Brown has done the anonymous scouting reports the last couple of years and I've edited them, as opposed to, you know, before we did this podcast, I actually used to do the interviews that were the underpinning for those. It just means that I go into these games with much more acute framing or things to watch. And when it comes to Syracuse's defense, one of the comments was about how Riley Figueres is such a sticky on-ball defender because of how good he is at getting his stick either into the hands or onto the stick head of the guy that he's covering. And I really thought, now granted, because he was covering Duffy and he was pretty limited in his mobility, it just was exaggerated. It really stood out. But it showed the effectiveness. We've already talked about Dwan and his ability to make contributions. Jordan Beck, I thought, played fine. You know, he obviously, as the third defenseman, both gets picked on a lot and also, is the target of a fair amount of criticism. Speaking of that, I have never been that high on Dante Bowen. I thought he was a surprising PLL draft pick. He played awesome in this game, and he was so confrontational on ball, and I was really, really impressed by what he was able to do. And then the LSMs, for me, Bolognino got run by once. Kaczynski made a couple of plays that made you scratch your head. Bobby Kittleberger had a clearing pass that went immediately out of bounds. That was the thing that I felt like was potentially even the most Syracuse-esque of this, the most Gary Gate-esque of this. When Syracuse teams are good, they have a hallmark to them, which is kind of a carefree flair. And there are times in which it just manifests in, like, what are you doing? Like, why would you make that decision? And it really felt like once Syracuse got the lead, when they were on their 5 or 6 goal run to get the lead back and then create, you know, to not get the lead back, they hadn't led at that point, but to you know, get and build a lead, they weren't making those mistakes. But then once they got the lead, it felt like they had gotten comfortable in the middle of the third quarter and they started to make those mistakes. And that's what opened the door for Carolina to ultimately tie it once more before they were able to separate like we talked about. But I mean, we can talk a little bit of legacy for what this means for this team. You know, I think that by virtue of making it back to the Final Four for the second year in a row, you can say some version of you have not it, you have crossed the threshold whereby it can be defined as a failure. So I don't think that you will be able to characterize this senior class's tenure as a failure. I think that is now off the table. I think this season, more acutely than their career or their last 2 years, is somewhere between not a failure and not a success right now. And I don't know if winning in the semifinal and losing the championship, it middles that somehow. Obviously, if you win a championship, it's a success. There's no more can be done. No more can be said. Where's your head at when it comes to this group?
I it's so, I feel like the responses that I see in here are very age dependent and we'll call it level of brain development dependent. Cause there are 50-year-old teenagers out there and there are literal teenagers out there. And I think if you asked me this while I was in college or right out of college, it was that very smooth brain, natty or bust type of scenario. And especially in a tournament like this, in a sport like this, with athletes as young as they are, they're in college, they're not professionals. You know, they're got to figure out what they're doing for internships. They're wrapping up classes. You know, graduation week is always one of my favorite things to see from all the social media accounts for these teams. Notre Dame graduated in Long Island just as the group of seniors and as a team. Like, there's a lot going on in life right now. And to make it to Memorial Day weekend, I think, is a success for any program, regardless of preseason expectations. So to me, this Syracuse going back-to-back is a success. And if they lose in the semis, they still made it to Memorial Day weekend. And in a really difficult sport in which who knows how any game is going to unfold, I think that's something that they'll probably, if they don't win the national championship, about be really, you know, and it might not shock you to hear that this is my take on it. It'll really mess with them for a couple years and be like, we could have gotten over the hump. We could have done this. We had all this weight on our shoulders. And in retrospect, 10 years down the line, you know, the Spallinas, the Dwans, when they're getting together over beers and talking about the worst practices they ever had and, you know, when they were puking and all that stuff, they'll say, you know what, we did something pretty special. We made it to 2 Memorial Day weekends in a row. We got Syracuse. I think Gary Gates said we're relevant again in his post-game interview.
Yeah, that was wild.
Which was that was kind of a crazy thing to say. But at the same point, like, I think that is the in a very weird roundabout way, I think that's like almost a mature take that you say after the season has ended or a month after the season has ended, not heading into Memorial Day weekend. But I would classify this Syracuse senior class as successful regardless of the outcome, unless they lose by 15.
Okay, well, so that actually is both a good kind of capstone, or, you know, entry to my point, which will be the last thing I think we talk about this game, and a segue into talking about Notre Dame Hopkins. So part of the reason, so you're saying success, I'm saying not a failure. There's obviously a lot of gray area in between those two things. Part of the reason that I feel like there has to be some measure of success if they fall short of a championship is because, in my estimation, they're at best the third best team playing on Memorial Day weekend. And I felt like beating Carolina was a matchup that was really conducive for them. I don't think Syracuse would have beaten Penn State had they played. I think, you know, would they have beaten Hopkins or Georgetown? You know, I don't know. Those are kind of, I think they probably would have beaten Georgetown. I think they probably would have lost to Hopkins. And I understand that they already beat Johns Hopkins during the regular season at Homewood. I'm saying they also lost twice to Carolina. So anyhow, let's get out of the hypothetical and knowables and back into the action as it was. Notre Dame 14, Johns Hopkins 9. This was a little bit more of an extreme version of the last game insofar as it was 6-6 at half. This is also kind of the theme for Princeton-Penn State as well insofar as the team that was the underdog was very resilient. And Carolina wasn't the underdog, but for the purposes of this conversation, they were. And did a really nice job of like taking the punch that was thrown by the favorite. Notre Dame blew it open in, call it the 12-minute to the 10-minute mark of the third quarter, so just after halftime. And while Hopkins was able to hang tough from that point, they got it back to two on one occasion, ultimately not able to get it to one, not able to get it tied. And you know, the fourth quarter really felt like they just didn't have the pop or the juice. This was the game that, you know, we talked about. I think the expectation was that it was going to be a little bit more defensive oriented, especially because Hopkins' defense had played Cornell so well, and obviously Notre Dame is a program best known for its defense. And I thought that Hopkins' offense did a nice job showing what it was going to be able to get outside of Matt Collison, who was certainly the focal point coming into this game, with Hunter Chauvet scoring off the dodge was something that was very much enjoyable. Charlie Eiler scoring the first goal of the game. You know, he's been a guy for whom I think a lot was expected coming in, but into the season, but hadn't necessarily met those expectations. That was nice to see. And ultimately, I think I don't think there was any scenario in which Hopkins was going to get to 14 or 15 on Notre Dame. But if there was another version of this game where they maybe faced off a little bit better and were able to keep it within, call it like 11, ultimately, in order to get to 11 or 12, they would have needed better days out of Jimmy Ayers and Chuck Rawson. Rawson had a nice nifty goal on the crease, but finished with 1-1. And, you know, that level of production just wasn't going to do it. Meanwhile, I was so proud of the headline and the lead that we came up with for this game on InsideLacrosse.com. Credit to McAneer, who was at Hofstra and covered this game. He literally, in our Slack, just said, F it, I'm doing it. One day, outer space, but first, Charlottesville. And then I felt the measure of inspiration, and I had to say, to the Final Four and beyond. So his was Space Force, mine was Buzz Lightyear, and ultimately, Josh Yago, 4 goals and 3 assists. As you said, completely erasing your legacy at Wheat Ridge and Notre Dame in 1 year. How's that feel?
Bad.
For those that don't know, Nick and Josh Yago, I have to assume, are far and away the two most successful Wheat Ridge lacrosse alums, both of whom ended up playing at Notre Dame.
Well, now be careful, because Wheat Ridge's program has disbanded. Yes. So I think Josh Yago is technically a Lakewood alum.
Got it.
But whatever. Feels bad, but feels so good at the same time. Inside of us, there are all two people from Wheat Ridge. One is, you know, kind of the bar degenerate who happens to be able to play college across. The other is a guy who's in the Space Force and is government property and is like literally the shining star of the town. I don't think you'll find Josh Yago doing a podcast 10 years after he graduates, but we're not going to talk about that, Terry. I loved how this game unfolded for a number of reasons. First was the competitive aspect of it in the first half. I don't like blowouts, even if it's my alma mater blowing a team out, and Hopkins, to their credit, made it interesting. And credit to Hopkins' offense in particular, even though they didn't, they weren't able to, I think, sustain a high level of quality scoring chances. You knew that Notre Dame's defensive plan, with how Hopkins' previous game went, was you are not going to have Matt Collison beat us. And Hopkins had a strategy going into it. And so it was kind of this interesting chess match to watch unfold. Okay, Hopkins is ready to have a true, or at least a better, 6-man unit, as opposed to just relying on, you know, one or two initiators and then see what happens from there. And then halftime happens. I thought Notre Dame made some really good adjustments on defense. But in particular, I think the head-scratching thing for me this entire season for Notre Dame has been, the consistency on offense, which we've talked about multiple times.
For sure.
And I kind of pinned it this game in particular, where I was like, what's been confusing about Notre Dame's offense? Are we a team that initiates and wants to shoot in the first 5 to 10 seconds of a shot clock? Or are we a team that wants to use our athleticism and our midfielders in particular to break down and wear down their defensive unit? And this game, to me, finally, it was the clearest way that Notre Dame has played, where it's like, we are willing to press in the first 5 to 10 seconds and in transition, but if it's not there, we can settle and regroup and get it. Like, we have two particular identities. We're pressing early, but if it's not there, we're not going to keep that aggressive momentum going into second 15 or 20. And so the lack of shots from like the 15 to 30 second mark, I really liked to see. We're pressing and we're taking advantage of a defense on their heels, or we're going to set out and do what we know we can do, which is let the the Yagos, the Jeffries, the Maharises, essentially just be in a better spot to wear down the collective Hopkins defense unit. I thought by the third, halfway through the third quarter, the separation that the initiators were getting was much more significant, whether that's strength and conditioning, whether that's just the depth of athleticism. It gave me a lot more confidence, heading into Memorial Day. So that's kind of my initial takeaway. I do want to give the caveat. I wasn't able to watch this live because I was running a clinic in Sun Valley, Idaho, for the underprivileged youth of the wealthiest town in Idaho. Great people up there. So I had to watch this on a replay as I was almost impromptu asked to babysit for a family. So it was me and two middle schoolers watching Notre Dame Hopkins and them just peppering me with questions the whole time. So I will rewatch this, but that's my initial takeaway.
No, I think it's exactly right. Insofar as Kyle Bergen took a shot, Christian Olakwa scored a goal. Will Angrick had an assist in early offense. But what was interesting is you're talking about the second phase and how that's where Hopkins has had so much success in the sub game. And that's not something that Notre Dame has tried to exploit, is probably the best word, over the course of the season. And it's been frustrating when, to your point, you haven't gotten consistent initiation. But I can't recall whether I said this on the podcast, because what I say on podcasts versus reality has become one of those lines of distinction that my brain just won't handle anymore. But there were times in April when Matt Jeffrey was garnering a lot of praise from other inside lacrosse folks and, just other lacrosse commentators that I had seen. And to be perfectly honest with you, the best way to describe it was like, I don't see it. And which isn't to say that I was down on him. I was so impressed by his versatility that he showed. How many guys played attack midfield and defensive midfield as freshmen last season? But I'm here to say I see it. I saw it last week. I see it now. And the impact that he had on the game, I'm not saying this because he had 2 goals and 3 assists. I'm saying this because the amount of attention that he required from Hopkins' defense was at another level. And what's compelling in contrasting this with the Cornell game is how Hopkins' defensive personnel is not going to be best deployed against Notre Dame's offensive personnel, because with what they get out of Carson Brown and Luke Martin is what you want, what Cornell is, right? Like, you want to have two offensive players that if you really take them out of the game, the gap between the second and third best offensive player is so wide that it affects that offense. That was just not going to happen for Notre Dame, right? Like, regardless of who Brown and Martin were deployed on, and I don't think either of them played particularly well because of the range shooting Notre Dame exhibited, right? The broadcast, I thought, did a really nice job of talking about Hopkins' desire off ball to pack it in. And that was a significant theme when you contrasted their performance defensively this year versus last year, was how much offense they created for opponents last year by sliding so fast, by oversliding, by being farther extended that they needed to be. And they had reformed this year, and one of the ways that manifested was by being more packed in. And it wasn't necessarily just in zone. It was an off-ball play when they were in man-to-man as well. And there were a couple of instances in which you saw Luke Martin be slow to close out on whoever his matchup was off of a skip pass, because Notre Dame has shooters that can hammer from 14 and 13, and Cornell didn't, and that was one of the differences. It's a good segue into talking about Orange Linus, who had been a key factor in Hopkins' turnaround. It seems unfair to call it that, because I don't think they were ever so down in the dumps that the season needed to be fully turned around, but certainly after the Carolina loss, you wouldn't have envisioned a quarterfinal team coming from those ashes. And again, to reference the anonymous scouting report, there was a line in there that talked about whether it's the sweatpants or the dancing, I feel like potentially he is allowing himself to be distracted. It was actually harsher than that. I don't remember exactly what it said. I have my thoughts. I want to hear yours first.
Just what? On people dogging on Jalinus because he has a personality?
Yes.
Shut up.
Okay, good.
And again, people, the general public gets to see a fraction of what goes into a season. And Jalinus, you know, dancing sweatpants. Guess what? He's probably doing that at 6 a.m. weights. He's probably doing that on a Tuesday afternoon practice in September.
And he's doing it in the games where he makes 17 saves in less than 10. My contention is that, yeah. Show me the correlation between playing poorly or the causation.
Well, and it's, yeah, I don't know. If he's been consistent with it, he's had great games. I mean, he had the save of the weekend, for sure, diving to the backside and stuffing. I can't remember who it was on the backside. Like, there's just no way that I think you can blame him. And especially, you know, God forbid a college athlete shows a little bit of personality. That's for the 6-year-old guy who just found out what Twitter was and is mad at the world and, you know, is probably, I was going to say something political there, but this isn't a political podcast, Terry. So I'm just going to leave it at that. But yeah, shut up.
Tyler Spano, a revelation. Aiden Diaz-Matos, taking some faceoffs in this one as well. It is when you said, I don't remember when it was, but it was probably late March, is my gut. You said if Notre Dame's not going to win national championship, their consistency of offense is going to be the reason why they didn't. Going all the way back to September of 2025, I said that I thought Diaz-Matos had the potential to be the most important player in the class of 2025 because I didn't think any other individual player had the potential to swing the outcome of a national championship like he did. Now, it turns out, I think, that was true in terms of Notre Dame's faceoff performance, but I didn't give enough credit to the WNL transfer who gets to go back to very nearly where he was in college for the prior 2 years and take some faceoffs in Scott Stadium. Do you feel like there is an exploitable hole that it will be the reason that Notre Dame loses? Or if Notre Dame does not win a national championship, do you think it's more likely of either they got beat by a team that played better that day, or, you know, it was just them's the breaks. That's sports.
No, I mean, honestly, it would be if I wasn't so now confident in how well-rounded the rest of the collective unit is. And I started to really develop this when we neutralized Wambach, because I thought we were going to lose that UNC game. UNC was hot. We were good, not great. You know, I think we were, what, 3 or 4? In my mind, maybe we were 1 or 2. But even if there's an exploitable hole at the faceoff position, I'm confident enough in our defense, particularly our goalie.
Who didn't even play our transition well against Hopkins.
He didn't. He did not have a great game, and you know it kind of brings me back to some of those 2022 Maryland teams, or like late teens, early 20s, where I'm like, to beat this Notre Dame team, you have to exploit the only exploitable hole, which is almost a game of whack-a-mole. Notre Dame could get hot at the X. Notre Dame could not. You know, you have to be prepared to get hot. You know, you have to have good goaltending. You have to have good settled offense. You have to prevent their transition. You have to have consistently good quality shots. So, you know, as I look for what would I do to prepare and try and scout Notre Dame, you know, it's almost, yeah, this game of whack-a-mole is the analogy that I keep coming back to, because you have to stop and prevent so many factors which they could use to win a game. Do you agree with that or disagree?
Well, to be clear, my question wasn't specifically addressing the face-off. It was more, do you think that there are any holes? And I don't think they do. I think it is – I am not – ready to say who I think is the better team between Princeton and Notre Dame, which means that I will not say which is the better team before the game occurs. I have picked Princeton, and that's a nice segue into talking about that game,
scumbag,
as my national champion for no other reason than because they get to play first. And if history has shown us anything, it is that it is really hard to win a national championship if you played second on Saturday. And as soon as Penn State lost, I could have imagined a scenario in which Penn State Duke would have been the second game. It would have been unlikely, but I could have imagined that scenario. But as soon as Penn State lost, it was like, there's no way they're putting Princeton in the second game. And I was like, so Princeton's going in the first game, and that to me means that they're going to win the championship. But that won't be because I think they're definitively better. I do think that the unit breakdown elements are interesting, and ultimately I don't think that there is a unit that's better than Princeton's offense. But either way, that will only be a test if both teams advance on Saturday. Notre Dame-Syracuse is a really interesting matchup. I will say I think that in the I want to say three-card Monty, but that's not really the best. Rock, paper, scissors nature of conference matchups, I will say I think Syracuse has had Notre Dame's number. It's so funny because in my memory of the, you know, going back to the Big East days when Syracuse was still at that time a historically superior program to Notre Dame, these teams played like one goal games, and Syracuse had Notre Dame's number, and then that, you know, completely flipped, and I was the dome for Notre Dame dropping a 17 bomb on Syracuse to spoil their 100th anniversary of the program celebration. Obviously the Jake Taylor game where he came back from injury and Notre Dame dropped 18 in the dome. Clearly Notre Dame has put it on the orange chin in recent years. But with that being said, you think back to the regular season game this year, and Syracuse played them really tough, right? You know, based on where both teams were when that game was played, I think that especially the way the first half and maybe even three quarters of memory serves unfolded, you came away impressed by what the Orange put on tape. Ultimately, I think the delta between those two teams is pretty wide. And so now let's talk about Princeton. 14-10 victors.
Well, let me tee up a segue real quick, because you ask about what holes are exploitable for Notre Dame. And I think, you know, a good takeaway from this weekend as well was their ability to play a number of different types of games, the fast run and gun, the settled sixes. We've kind of touched on that. What gave me optimism in this Princeton game, even though they came away with a victory, they almost got, Big Ten footballed, and they got kind of dragged into a game that Penn State wanted to play from a pace and a chaos perspective. Penn State knew that they weren't going to be able to win in true 6-on-6 against Princeton's offense, because I agree with you. Princeton's offense, I think, is the best single unit, offense, defense, face-off, goalie. You know, Princeton's offense is one of one. That being said, why I'm confident is they got a little bit dragged away from that. And that gives me confidence that Notre Dame can kind of drag Princeton into a dogfight, not looking past the Syracuse game, not looking past Princeton Duke. That was my takeaway from Princeton Penn State. Terry, how'd that game go?
Yeah, so you kind of mentioned it. I felt like the story of the game was Penn State's resilience. Every time it felt like Princeton positioned themselves to pull away, the Nittany Lions had an answer offensively, which was particularly impressive because Hunter Aquino, who was the player of the game, at least by some measures, I think ours, against Army, obviously coming off of injury. He missed five games, I believe, due to injury earlier this season. And at one point in the first half, took a little bit of a false step. He has a tight over his right leg and limped really heavily off the field after throwing the ball out of bounds. To me, it looked like, you know, one of those movements where, ironically, the turf didn't give you the support that you were expecting, and so as a result, your foot slipped back. I don't know if it was a hamstring or a calf. That was definitely looked like one of the two to me, you know. But whether it was Jonjude Constantine in a crazy play when he was getting dragged to the ground to just keep the ball on his stick. But so Princeton scores three straight to go up 6-4 with 3 minutes to go in the second quarter. And Chase Robertson and Andrew Beard respond with two to tie it at six at half. Just really remarkable. But the story at half was Aquino's absence. So to come out and get Kyle Lehman a goal 61 seconds in, and then Jack Iantuono to feed Mark Waters to now extend the lead to 8-6 with 11:42 to go in the third, was, again, really impressive. Princeton throws another punch, three straight goals, and then Liam Matthews and Chase Robertson gets it back to 10-9. Ultimately, that was as close as it was going to get. And it was the last time that Penn State was going to score, because Quinn Kramer in transition, John Dunphy off of a Chad Palumbo feed, McMeekin off of a faceoff win 5 seconds after that goal. I mean, that was really the backbreaker. That made it 12-10. And then Tucker Wade and Cooper Mueller had an empty net goal to seal the scoring. But it was interesting insofar as, you know, McMeekin played well. And obviously when a faceoff guy scores a goal, it's going to be even more meaningful. I thought that one of the most under-discussed elements of faceoff matchups is the role that violating plays, especially if you violate early in the game. And I thought that it was meaningful that Penn State violated on the opening faceoff. And then on top of that, Ryan Kroduk, again, you know, I mean, we're talking about teamer All-American goalies. I had Thomas Richardelli is my first team All-American. I believe Ryan Kroduk was the media first team All-American in terms of the vote result. And now the guy had a great game. Both teams are advancing to the championship weekend. It's a pretty remarkable outcome. I spent a lot of time thinking this week about the value of statistics. And when I say that, what I mean is a goal is worth one goal, right? Obvious statement. An assist is worth one goal. You throw an assist, it equals a goal for your team. A ground ball is arguably worth a half of a goal, that's not true. Let me take this one step back. In the scenario in which teams score on a third of their possessions, which is about average, the range is typically, you know, high 20s on the low end and high 40, or I'm sorry, 40%, maybe a shade over on the high end. So let's just say it averages out to 33%. Then garnering your team possession is worth a third of a goal. And so a 50-50 ground ball, you pick it up, it's worth a third of a goal. A caused turnover is worth two-thirds of a goal, because you're taking away the scoring opportunity for your team, you're giving it to, or for the opponent, you're giving it to your team, whatever. A save is worth more than a goal, because you're taking a goal off the board, and then assuming an effective, a successful clear, which let's just say that averages about 85% of the time, then you're giving your team a 33% chance of scoring. So if you do that math, I think it roughly comes out to a save is worth about 1.3 goals, which I think is just putting a number to something that everybody understands intuitively. It's one of the things that I can understand is frustrating about lacrosse and hockey, which is in the same way that basketball sometimes just comes down to hot three-point shooting, sometimes lacrosse and hockey can just come down to hot goaltending, and that seems oversimplified. But with that being said, it is, I think, remarkable, again, that these teams were able to advance the championship weekend without average, based on their season-long production, goalie play, much less good goalie play. And so, you know, I think for Princeton, you can be really pleased, you can be really proud, and you can be happy with the way in which you settled down. I thought that Palumbo's halftime interview, when it was 6-6, was reflective of a guy who was just like, how are we tied with this team? You know, certainly didn't say that and wouldn't say that, but that was kind of the vibe that he gave off. And then again, coming out of half, they go behind two, and then they scored 8 of the game's last 10 goals in order to kind of win comfortably going away.
Well, it's really funny to hear you break down those statistics. So just so you listeners know, you know, you're working with two elite caliber minds here. That's what Terry thinks about. And before we started recording, I was pitching him on anti-commercials where companies can pay us to trash their competitors. So
an idea that I totally love, and to yes and Nick in that idea, what I want to put it out is I'm going to guess that like 80% of our listeners are lax dads, and I'm going to guess that 40% of that 80% has a black enough heart that there is another kid, not their kid, a different kid, whether because they don't like the dad or because they don't like the kid as a player, who they want us to talk shit about. And I am considering a business opportunity that for a fee, I will talk shit about the kid that you don't like on this podcast.
It's, I mean, yeah. What do you want to retire tomorrow? But sorry, just got sidetracked when you were talking about the statistical analysis and my brain, the monkey clapping cymbals up there, thinking about how we can get people to, you know, play in the pig pen online. You know, there were two surprising things for me. One, I really liked, Penn State's ride, and to an extent, their aggressiveness on approaches defensively and how quickly they were rotating. And, you know, they're kind of playing that funky zone a little bit, because there were an uncharacteristic amount of missed open passes for Princeton. You know, if you were watching the game, it probably looked like there were some easy passes that Princeton just didn't hit, whether it was a skip pass, whether it was on the clear. And I think that was a byproduct of Penn State's aggressiveness. So credit to them for saying, hey, we got the number one seed. Let's come out and punch them in the mouth. And then to your point, and this is why I'm cautious to put weight towards this in the hypotheticals that we were just talking about, if it's Notre Dame, Princeton. You know, and I'm already game planning, how are we going to beat Syracuse? How are we going to beat Duke? What's the scout against Princeton? There were at least four that I can remember where a Penn State offensive player is winding up, and I'm like, oh no, don't shoot that. You're shooting on Krotik. Like, this is going to be transition the other way. And those four went in. So, you know, again, I'm cautious to index too much into that just because I know that that's not a sustainable game plan. But at the same time, what I do think is a little bit sustainable is the aggressiveness with which you can take it to Princeton, knowing that their X factors are how good they are in 6-on-6 offense. And as a byproduct of that, whether it's consciously or subconsciously, they probably have gotten some bad defensive performances from their opponents over the course of the year. Whether athletes will admit it or not, I knew that when I was going up against, we'll call it Jordan Wolf, because he was the guy that would toast me the most consistently and easiest, like, you're gripping your stick a little bit tighter. Your legs are locking up a little bit more. Like, the weight of going up against what you know to be the number one unit or player inherently can mess with you a little bit. And I thought that Penn State did a good job not having that. You know, Princeton, that classic Princeton, oh, they're up 5-1 at the end of the first quarter. So overall, I really enjoyed the first half of this game, enjoyed most of the third quarter. And this was one of those games where, and I feel this way about certainly UNC Cuse, but there were a couple moments in the fourth quarter where I was like, if Penn State gets this one, things are about to get real interesting.
Yeah.
Kind of seemed like that. If one domino falls, this game is going to go be an instant classic, and it's going to be the ultimate chaos. Unfortunately, that didn't happen, which I think is credit to Princeton for maintaining their composure. But man, there were that, like, you know, 2-minute stretch halfway through the fourth, you know, Penn State pushing in transition. They get this, watch out.
Yeah, so a couple of things. The first was, to your point about when you're preparing for Jordan Wolf, that's another reason to be particularly impressed by Johnny Mullen's performance, because, and I know we're going back a couple of games, but, you know, to know that pressure was coming in terms of how important his role was going to be with Brady Wambach. To the point that you made about not shooting on Krotik, I'm going to go to the other end of the field. And first of all, Preston Hawkins had an absolutely awesome day, and definitely gave his team a chance to win. So that's great, because he had been a question mark at times, especially early in the season. Now, of course, freshman goalie, you know, you got to allow for that. And sometimes that's going to happen. But also, one of the elements of that was Princeton hit three pipes on one possession in the first quarter. And so I felt like there was an interesting contrast. All season, Penn State has been a team that was regarded as coming out of the gates hot. And if you survive the Avalanche, then you can play with them. And certainly in Hopkins' comeback in the regular season, that was a really meaningful, you know, kind of pockmark against them. But then the other side of the coin was, so effectively the question I asked was, who feels better about the way the first quarter unfolded? Princeton for having survived that potential onslaught, or Penn State because Princeton had gotten so many looks and they were still up one? And ultimately, I think the correct answer was Princeton for a variety of reasons. But ultimately, I think, again, it just speaks to, so you have a goalie that makes 17 saves, you hit three pipes on one possession, and you still put up 14 goals. And this notion that they're the best unit remaining, or not remaining, just this season in college lacrosse is very defendable. Anything more on this one, or shall we talk about the Blue Devils advancing back to championship weekend?
Boy, the Blue Devils brought a gun to a fist fight. I mean, this was insane. I love this, because ACC, now I get to, you know, be that insufferable ACC guy, which is what I put my name on for this podcast. Oh, nice. The worst team in the ACC is now going to the Final Four. But yeah, tell me again how good the Ivy League is. Wish Larkin was on here, but it was the long play. It was, hey, you know, we always lose a game in February and then we get better and better. And come May, you're going to be scared of us. It's no, let's delay that. Let's schedule a bunch of patsies. Let's lose all the ACC games and then let's get monstrously hot. Cause this game was over halfway through the first quarter. I mean, there were moments in which Georgetown, you know, showed sparks of life, but the biggest thing to me, and I don't want to throw too much at you, how did this Georgetown team beat Virginia, which I would say is kind of a comparable roster, not really, but a comparable size game plan to Duke?
A team that beat Duke for the first time in regular season in 23 years or 22 years.
What are we doing? Like, what are we doing here? This just doesn't make sense to me. Who is Georgetown? Who is Duke? Who is Virginia? I don't know anything about anything.
No, it's the right framing. And, it, you know, so I mentioned at the top of the podcast that last week was our most listened to episode of the year. And we recorded it during the second half of Georgetown's win over Virginia. And it was fun. And, you know, we've done it a few times, especially with Georgetown, right? Because 2 years ago, you're watching that Notre Dame lose to Georgetown was, I think, the most listened to episode of the season. The downside of that was I realized, because, you know, we finished recording, I turned the second half of the game on while I was editing it, and I was like, we talked about the failed clears, we talked about going offsides, we talked about the slipperiness, but we did not do nearly a good enough job of highlighting the fact that Georgetown turned the ball over 8 possessions in a row, and Virginia went offsides 4 times. To directly answer your question, and this is going to sound like I'm discrediting Georgetown. I don't mean to, and I don't think that I am. Virginia played that game the way that they played in February. They sped themselves up so much, or they allowed themselves to be sped up so much. I believe on all 3 games, we've talked about the desire to dictate tempo and flow with respect to playing to your team's advantage. And I mean, it's pretty clear that when you analyze Georgetown, Virginia just didn't emphasize that. With respect to Duke 16, Georgetown 6, I'm going to push back a little bit on the game felt like it was over in the first quarter, halfway through the first quarter, because Georgetown scored first, 30 seconds into the game. Duke scored to tie it at 1-1 with 9 minutes and 29 seconds to go in the first quarter. And then there was 7 minutes of scoreless action. And it was just like, I felt it kind of like the way that we were watching Princeton get better looks against Penn State, that Duke was getting the better looks. And Georgetown was, in my opinion, just a lot of unforced turnovers. They had 4 turnovers in the first quarter, 7 in the second, 15 on the game. And they weren't in the clears. I mean, they failed one clear in the first half, so this was in settled offense. It was a really frustrating and disappointing offensive performance from Georgetown. But I don't want to take so much of the credit away from Duke's defense. Did you see anything from Duke defensively in the first half that you felt like deserves to be called out for why Georgetown struggled so much offensively?
Just on ball stickiness kind of felt like, you know, on ball stickiness could mean a number of different things. And, you know, I'll be repeating myself from probably every fourth episode right now, but the best testament to a defense is making easy passes difficult. And as Jerry Byrne would say, impacting the quality of simple passes. And so it seemed like when Georgetown tried to initiate, when they were getting ready to even make a simple transfer pass to below GLE, it just seemed like there was a Duke defender that was making that pass, you know, throwing a lift check or staying on the hip just enough to make that next pass down at the feet, reaching over, or a turnover. I probably should have said halfway through the second quarter, but, you know, kind of from the get-go, it seemed like Georgetown's offense, when they got a good look, I was like, oh, wow, that, you know, that was not normal for that set.
Well,
and
okay,
Duke would...
So, I don't know if this is disagreeing with you, but I when Georgetown would score, my reaction is like, why haven't they been able to do that for 25 minutes? Like, when they actually made plays that looked good, they didn't feel unsustainable or non-repeatable. So that was where I was frustrated, was that, you know, the simple exchange passes that were going out of bounds were just happening 3/4 of the time they brought the ball down the field. It was head-scratching.
Well, and call it the yips. I think I'm too eager to credit defense, and like I'm using on-ball stickiness and kind of getting into the weeds of what that means. But at the end of the day, like, is there another explanation other than on half the possessions Georgetown just pissed the ball away? Like, moment too big? I don't think so. This isn't a program that I would think, you know, is intimidated by a Duke team coming off the heels of winning against Virginia at Virginia. So the what we were just talking about, you know, defending Jordan Wolf or going against Princeton 6-on-6, I don't think that Georgetown would have that. You know, it was hot. A lot of guys were cramping on that field, you know, kind of for both games, but I think that's a bit of a wash. There was so much head scratching, but when you said right there, like, I'm almost going to disagree with you disagreeing. Yeah. When Georgetown scored, they made it look easy, but
not
they
easy,
didn't
just
have,
good.
Yeah, sustainable, we'll call it. It just didn't seem like they had a sustainable core of fundamentals from the opening draw. And who knows what to chalk that up to. Like, as a former player, there have been games in which you get the yips and those 10-yard passes kind of starting to look like 20, 30-yard passes. But you and knowing how well of a program, you know, they're coached well, there are ways that you can get those out of your system. Shorten the passes, you know, move it around and everybody gets settled. And to me, it just ended up being, I don't know, compounding mistakes, first turnover. How do you respond to that? It's certainly not with a second turnover, which leads to a third, which leads to a fourth. And then by the time that the Avalanche has already started, there's no coming back from that.
Yeah, I mean, it is unfortunately very justifiable for this program to get the yips in the quarterfinals, because this was their 14th quarterfinal appearance and they have won once. And it was the second time they made it. So they made it to the quarters for the first time in 98. They won and made it to the Final Four in 99. And they have been back 12 times since, including in 2000, the following year. And now they have lost in this round gone to the playoffs 4 consecutive years and 5 of the last 6. So again, justifiable that getting over this hump is something that's in the minds of the players, because it would mean so much for the program if they were able to do it. But yeah, I'm not going to attribute it to coaching. I do think that we're being a little bit unfair. You know, I use the expression all the time that a 12-8 game is the hardest game to analyze, because you can basically say you can make all 4 arguments. Offense won, offense won the game, offense lost the game, defense won the game, defense lost the game, whatever. A 16-6 game, obviously the team that scored 6 goals, their offense didn't do well enough. Fortunately, this is a game in which both goalies played pretty well, so it wasn't as if either goalie lost it. And the faceoff unit, the faceoff game performance was pretty even as well. So I feel like the element that we haven't spent enough time talking about was Duke's offense. And coming away from the Richmond game, the very clear storyline was those non-Ben Johnston, Max Sloat contributors showed up, matured, carried their weight, showed that, okay, maybe this is the team that we've been waiting for the whole time. They get 4-1 from Sloat, 3 goals from Johnston, and still get that complimentary scoring. So obviously, Kyle Colsey, 2-2, that's what you want out of your third attackman. It's great to see. Brady Scialetti, 1-1, Liam Kirschus, 2 assists. Thomas Menke, who wasn't a part of that explosion last week with 2 goals, I thought looked really dangerous. So, Anthony Drago, who scored his first goal last week, didn't get on the score sheet, but Ian Dykes did. So, I guess the point is, in order for Duke to reach its ceiling, which is the third best team in the tournament, I don't see any scenario in which they're better than Notre Dame and Princeton. Doesn't mean that they can't win twice, but in order for them to do it, it seems like it's imperative that they get that offensive performance out of their complementary scoring pieces. I wouldn't even say that they did everything that they could from a generating offense and transition standpoint. So a really nice offensive performance at a really important time for the Devils.
Well, and 2 in a row, too. You know, anybody can have one good offensive game.
Three in a row when you go back to
three.
Carolina.
Yeah, yeah. This is the version of Duke that is scary. No disrespect to the Syracuse fans. I'm glad we're playing Syracuse and not Duke this weekend. And honestly, the thing that I'm most excited about for this upcoming semifinal, is the Princeton versus Duke goalie battle, because good old Denver, Colorado, just breeding ground for Final Four starters. Except for its Valor, so whatever. I've been really, really impressed with his play on high degree of difficulty saves.
You're talking
anybody
about
can
Buck
stop
Cunningham,
those, you know, third. Yes,
Buck.
Bucky Cunningham, good old Buck. Buck was my first dog's name. Buck. I love, because not all saves are made the same, and he's making the saves that he should. But he's making some really high degree of difficulty saves from well-placed and good angle shots. And so watching him go against Krotik and seeing which offense is going to get frustrated, really interesting to see that. And then for Princeton, it almost becomes Duke to me almost seems like a more well-rounded Hopkins in a sense. You got the firepower, but you're starting to see a more proven depth. And it's not that Sloat is drawing so much attention that it's just the backside is open every time. Like, the depth on Duke's offense, they can initiate. They can make a read on a skip pass. They can finish. So it's kind of this it's a difficult task for Princeton heading into this, comparing the body of Duke's work throughout the entire regular season versus what they put on film in the last 3 days. Really curious to see how much Princeton's defense is going to stop the two-headed monster versus how much they're going to say, we know we need to give them attention, but we can't do that at the risk of, having 10 goals from the secondary players.
Nick, that was a really dense 75 minutes of analysis. You got anything else?
Who's Vegas favorite? What do you think right now?
I mean, I would assume Princeton.
Terry's Vegas. Terry's version of Vegas.
Well, I already picked Princeton, so I'm assuming that Princeton is the favorite, is the betting
favorite.
Yeah,
I know that, but that was before. No, shh.
What, you think Notre Dame's favorite?
Yes, I guess. Okay. I mean, I kind of have to right now.
Yeah, I mean,
I kind of have to. So I would say Notre Dame, Princeton, Duke, Syracuse in that order.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, I mean, they have online sports books for this. Do you have the ability to navigate to one right now? Because I don't.
Yes, we do, but I don't want to. That's not people don't. People are checking Vegas odds anyway.
Yeah. By the time, what are the Nick and Terry odds? I'm sure the odds are going to fluctuate dramatically based on our podcasting.
Notre Dame -110, Princeton +105, Duke +135, Syracuse +150.
I'm surprised that Duke is ahead of Syracuse. I mean, you said that, so I suppose in that way I shouldn't be, but I am kind of surprised by that. Interesting, just because of the matchup. But I guess, again, yeah, if they're playing the second favorite, then so be it. All right, to end this, obviously we have our normal sign-off, but because of we're play acting as a different podcast, can you when you tell me you love me also say adios amigos?
Adios amigos.
That'll do it for the Tailgate podcast. If you like what you heard, tell a friend, leave a rating and review, and we'll be back next week with one more season's weekend to analyze. We'll have more tailgates deeper into the summer, but we will only have live game action to discuss one more time. And Nick, I really appreciated your emotional vulnerability and availability at the top of this show. We love talking lacrosse, and we've only got one more weekend left to do it.
You know, it's called growth. It's called growth. I think we could all learn something from my emotional availability. Love you, Terry Miamore.
Adios, amigos.